American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life. When the words all come down like blues on Tuesday.
Ladies.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines.
Hello.
I'm Amy.
And I am B. Arthur's former personal assistant on the set of Maud.
No, that's Joe. And this is the podcast.
Gary Flanges.
Oh, okay. That wasn't
Gary P. Flanges.
This is the podcast that brings you all the nostalgic, crazy, and interesting facts and factoids from the decades gone by year. And tonight, we are heading into 1974.
I swallowed my socks.
Okay, 1974.
1974. We're on a brand new year.
Sorry to start a new year.
I'm sorry that it took us three episodes to finish 1973.
That's the way. It was hard. It was hard to come up with three weird things. I mean,
yeah, it's harder for you, but for me, everything I'm finding in the 70s is just so dang interesting.
I know.
That I got to delve more. I got to know more.
That's right.
And you can't just like touch on these things when it's like, wait, what the hell happened?
Right. I get it.
So we got to expound on some shit.
I'm hip, baby. You know what I mean? Said in the 70s, I'm hip.
And so part of this is learning. It's a history podcast. We're learning history.
Yep. That's
right. And so it's an educational for the children. You should have your elementary school kids listen to this fucking podcast.
All right. What's the first event we're going to talk about?
Before we get in, we got some corrections and apologies from last episode to do.
Oh.
Okay.
All right.
And you owe our listeners an apology.
Because
you insisted, and you're so convincing of a person that you're always sure you're right. You're so convincing that you had both me and our special guest Muppet, our beautiful red-cheeked buddy Muppet, our guest last week. You had us both convinced that Mork from Ork was not on Happy Days.
Well,
you were so sure.
Well, here's the thing. Here's what I remember saying. Mork and Mindy were not on Happy Days. That's what I said. I said Mork and Mindy were not on Happy Days.
Don't go down this road.
I did not say just Mork. Mork and Mindy. She was not on Happy Days.
You're right about that.
And that's what, them together, not on Happy Days. That was what I was trying to say.
That's not. If you listen back, you directly replied
to. Nobody needs to listen back. No. It's not necessary.
No, you listen back.
No, it's not necessary to listen back.
I'll listen back. Because if you listen back, I said, no, I am pretty sure Mork appeared on Happy Days. I remember seeing him on Happy Days. And you're like, no, that didn't happen. And you laughed, actually, at how stupid I was. And then,
this is Mork and Mindy on Happy Days.
No, just Mork. You said Mork. He was not on there. That was not on there. It was in the 70s. It couldn't have been in the 50s, whatever. And you even convinced Muppet that he was like, oh, you're right. I have Pam Dauber mixed with Cindy Williams. Like, he completely
got so scared.
No. He wasn't joking. He doesn't joke. He doesn't kid about.
But Cindy Williams isn't on Happy Days either.
Yes, she was. Shirley.
Cindy Williams was on Happy Days?
Laverne and Shirley. Remember, it was a spinoff of Happy
Days.
Oh,
that's right.
We talked about that. We established that. But so was Mork and Mindy. And so, but you did bring up a conundrum. I was like, okay, you are right that Mork and Mindy was set in the 70s. So how did they do that?
Yeah.
So I did look up and see that they explained that away by saying that Mork was a time traveler.
Oh, so.
He was also an alien and a time traveler. And the whole reason Mork and Mindy existed is because they decided to do that alien angle on Happy Days, and
the
fans.
That must have been after the Jump the Shark episode.
It had an alien
on Happy Days.
It got ridiculous. Happy Days got ridiculous.
Really bad.
I mean, some folks think it got ridiculous when, you know, Fonzie jumped the shark. Some when an alien showed up, and some when Tom Bosley did that episode where he tucked his junk.
The nude shower scene.
He tucked his junk, and he was like, look at me. Yeah. I'm a lady now.
That was.
And he was walking around naked.
He was making people rub lotion on himself.
Yeah, rub lotion. And there was a shower, the 20-minute shower. The whole episode was just Tom Bosley in the shower.
Yeah, that was.
That was
a
Carmine,
weird one.
Carmine
okay.
rubbing his back.
Is that all for corrections and apologies?
No, I think, crap, there was another one too, but I've forgotten since.
Is it another thing I supposedly did?
Randy Savage, it was the Tampa Tarpons was
nobody cares about that.
The team that he was playing on, the minor league team. Nobody,
not one human being when listening
he,
cares
when
about
he
that.
When he debuted as the Spider in wrestling, it was the off season of baseball. So okay. There was that, but there's probably, I think there was one other thing that was probably television related that we got wrong that you were like, oh, I think this, and you're like, dead wrong.
Oh, okay.
But I can't remember that. So if I remember
it later, I'm sure you'll remember it and wake me up in the middle of the night to tell me.
I will. And then we will come downstairs and record this podcast.
Yep. All right.
The correction. Okay. But let's jump right into 1974, shall we?
All right.
74. Do you know anybody born in 74?
I'm sure I do. I think.
Name them all.
Joy and Katie were both at 74.
Were they? My brother Andy was born in 1974.
Yeah.
In July. As we do, I like to jump into some things that don't really have dates, but they're notably 1974. Some quotes.
Okay.
Some famous quotes from 1974 were, or slogans were, "Taste great, less filling."
Okay.
That began in 1974. You know what product that's for?
"Taste great, less filling." God, it's on the tip of my tongue.
No, it's not. It's in your gut.
"Taste great, less filling."
Taste great.
Was it a soda?
No, beer.
Oh, it was a beer.
Yeah, because less filling, tastes great. Because you want to drink a bunch of beer.
Bud Light or Miller Light?
Miller Light.
Miller Light.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yes. And if
that
you,
went on for a long time. That tastes
forever.
Great, less filling.
I think it's still going, maybe.
I don't know about that. But
don't try to deny it.
I won't insist that I'm right.
I wouldn't, because you've learned that every time you insist you're right, you're dead wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite thing about this was, when I was a kid, and anytime you'd ride the Gemini at Cedar Point in Ohio, there's like two cars. There's a red car and a blue car, like series of cars. And you're riding at the same time with another car, and you're kind of racing them.
Yeah.
And then one goes ahead. And one time when I was on that ride, people started an argument, a chant on one of the cars. One would yell, "Taste great," and the other car would yell, "Less filling."
That's
and they would
stupid.
Yell, "Taste great, less filling." We do it the whole time.
That's really stupid.
It was really stupid, but I was a kid, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
You thought it was funny, yeah.
Yeah, because everybody on the whole car participated, and there was like, you know, there's like several people in a roller coaster.
I get it.
Yeah, it's fun. Dynamite.
Oh, JJ.
That came out in 1974. Jimmy Walker.
Yeah.
JJ, Jimmy Walker, and do you know what? We talked about this. That was a spinoff of a show.
Of was it? All in the Family? No, that was the Jeffersons. Oh, God.
Here's a hint. I'm the personal assistant to the lead character on this show. I was. Earlier, I pretended to be.
Personal assistant?
In the intros, I pretended to be.
Oh, B. Arthur. Oh, it was Maude.
Yeah, Good Times was a spinoff of Maude. Remember we talked about that?
I don't remember that.
Now, in 1973, we talked about Florida Evans was a character on Maude.
Oh, right.
And then we got in that whole spinoff
conversation. That's right.
Where I talked about, did you know that Golden Palace existed? That was a spinoff of
Golden Girls. That's right.
Because I found this whole website. It's just a list of all the spinoffs of every show. It's an awesome
How many hours did you spend on that when you could have been cleaning the house?
Six and a half. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the house, what I find is if I don't clean the house, it cleans itself. So
okay. We're not,
it's
we're
like
not going
a vagina.
Down this road.
The house is like a vagina.
All right. Okay.
A we're self-cleaning. Not going
Yep. Well, no, I'll see you later. It's been fun.
All right. Well, Amy has left the podcast, so now it's just me. Another quote for you listeners, since Amy's not here. She's back.
I'm back.
Oh, you're back. "Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer." You know what that's from?
No. I don't. Like, I think I will once you say it.
Al Pacino says it in a movie.
Oh, I don't think I saw. What is it?
The Godfather, Part 2.
Oh, I've seen The Godfather, yeah.
Part 2?
I just didn't remember
you saw
that
part
was
two?
That was it. Yeah, I've seen that, Part 2. Oh. I've seen both of them, but
there was three of them. You can't say both.
I think I've seen all three of them, actually.
The third one, I think, notoriously sucks, right?
It was in the theaters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also in January, the Post-it note was invented by Arthur Fry.
Who was? I thought it was invented by a woman.
Didn't the
guy in the Monkees, wasn't that his mom and dad or something?
I think the
Mike from the Monkees.
Mike Nesmith?
Yeah, I think.
No, you're way off.
I've heard that. I can't be the only person that heard that.
Well,
maybe that's an urban legend.
It's not
that Mike
a,
from the Monkees.
You're the only person who's ever heard it.
Parents invented Post-it notes. Well, now it is. I'm gonna make it up.
Here's the thing. In 1968, Dr. Spencer Silver, a scientist at 3M in the U.S., he was attempting to develop a super strong adhesive. Instead, he accidentally created a low-tack, reusable, pressure-sensitive adhesive. For 5 years, he promoted his solution without a problem within 3M, both informally and through seminars, but failed to gain acceptance. In 1974, a colleague who attended one of his seminars, Art Fry, came up with the idea of using the adhesive to anchor his bookmark in his hymn book. Fry then utilized 3M's officially sanctioned permitted bootlegging policy to develop the idea. The original note's yellow color was chosen by accident, as the lab next door to the Post-it team had only yellow scrap paper to use.
Okay.
Also, liposuction was invented in 1974.
Was it that long ago, huh?
In Italy. Well, the idea, they were already cutting fat surgically, I guess, out of people. But this is around 74 is when they first came up with the idea to suck it out. But I don't think they actually performed the first liposuction surgery till later, but they were came up with the idea to start trying to develop
the suck fat
technology. But it was in Rome.
Oh, I wonder, do people still get liposuction? Yeah, I guess they do.
I don't know anybody who has, do you?
No, I don't know anybody who has, but I think people still do.
You know what? That might be something to start asking people. Hey, did you get lipo?
Yeah. You look great. Did you get lipo?
Did you get lipo? I'm going to ask everybody who comes back from maternity leave.
Yeah. Well, what'd you do? Get lipo?
You get lipo, liposuction? Or just start recommending people. You know what you could use?
You could get a little lipo.
Some lipo.
Some lipo. Take that right out.
You know what? You look great, except for right here. Liposuction might help that.
A little bit of lipo.
I think, yeah.
It's cosmetic surgeons.
It's good to do that at the office.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I can't see any
harm complimenting people with it. Yeah. I think that's funnier.
You look so good, except from...
Did you get lipo?
All right. Monday, January 7th, 1974. Jane Goodall was born.
No.
Jane Goodall got laid.
No.
Jane Tell Goodall got pregnant?
Okay. No.
No, this is actually really interesting. Jane Goodall, she observed a social rift in a community of chimpanzees that turned into a violent 4-year civil war.
Oh, my God.
For territory involving kidnapping, rape, and murder.
Oh, my God.
Completely changing her perception of chimpanzees. It is known as the Gombe Chimpanzee War.
She watched it?
She was observing all these colonies of chimpanzees.
So she watched chimpanzees raping each other?
Yeah, and she liked it.
No, she liked it.
She didn't like it. No, she was shocked. Yeah, let me tell you. So the first outbreak of violence occurred on January 7th, 1974, when a party of 6 adult Kasakela males attacked and killed Gobi, a young Kahama male who had been feeding in a tree. This was the first time that any of the chimpanzees had been seen to deliberately kill a fellow chimp. Yeah. Over the next 4 years, all 6 of the adult male members of the Kahama, that's like one tribe of the chimpanzees, were killed by the Kasakela males.
For like revenge?
Yeah. It started a battle. Yeah. Of the...
So that feel revenge.
Well, the Kasakela ones were the ones that killed Gobi first.
Oh,
and then they just, I'm sure the Kahamas were retaliating, but
that's amazing that chimpanzees feel that revenge is a very complicated emotion.
Yeah, and they're fighting over territory just like people do.
Yeah,
of the females from Kahama, 1 was killed, 2 went missing, and 3 were beaten and kidnapped by the Kasakela males.
Oh my God!
Kasakela then succeeded in taking over Kahama's territory.
That screensaver option that I mentioned earlier could really fix that.
I'm gonna punch myself in the balls. But these territorial gains were not permanent.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just doing that.
Oh, stop doing that. Because when the Kahama were gone, the Kasakela's territory now butted up directly against the territory of another chimpanzee community.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
Called the Kalande. And they had superior strength.
You think the chimpanzees come up with those names?
Numbers. Yeah.
Do you think they sat around and, what should we be called?
Well, and that's
hey, guys.
Well, that's the funny part of it is Jane Goodall kind of has a quote about this outbreak where she was shocked by it, and she calls them by their names that she's given them, like Sniffles and Rudolph. And I can't believe
Sniffles raped Rudolph so badly.
Yeah, Rudolph drank the blood right out of Sniffles' skull. It's really really upset. And Pepe ripped the skin off of Fido and started hitting again and quivering the body of Goliath, one of his childhood heroes. So there's all kinds of just like, she was just like shocked.
Wow.
But it really revealed to Jane Goodall the dark side of chimpanzee behavior.
Yeah. Chimpanzees are assholes.
They're just like us.
There was a chimpanzee that ripped like a woman's face off. She recently? Had it as a pet. It was I think it was in the 2000s.
Well, they're wild animals.
Yeah, she had it as a pet. And
it's a wild animal.
It became an adult, and it ripped her face off.
Yes. Or you shouldn't have it as a pet.
And it killed her. But, I mean, her face
was... It's a wild animal.
Oh, I know. I just...
Lady, I mean, I'm not...
I heard that 911 call.
Oh, why? Why did you listen to that?
I don't know. Something's wrong with me.
Something is wrong with you. Why would you listen to that?
It was on a podcast. Last podcast on the left was playing 911 calls. I listened to that episode.
How could you listen to that?
I don't know.
Like, you know, get it Spotify or something. Get a playlist.
Gosh,
there's so many music apps out there. You can just listen to some pleasant songs. You don't have to listen to 911 calls. There's something wrong with you. That's the crux of the thing. Like, what? Why are we doing this? I like Maud, and you like to listen to 911 calls. It's just, you know, watch Three's Company reruns for once.
It's
like it's
almost
a light,
Halloween,
airy,
you know,
fluffy.
It's kind of Halloweenish.
Anyway, not to be judgmental of that lady, but if you bring a wild animal into your house, you can't be upset when it rips your face off.
Yeah.
Saturday, January 12th, 1974, the Steve Miller Band knocks Jim Croce off the Billboard number one spot.
Yeah.
With a song.
Who
from the 1973 album
who
The Joker.
Steve Miller.
Steve Miller Band.
Okay.
Do you know what song it is?
The Joker?
The Joker,
that's
yeah.
what you said.
Well, it's a song off the album, The Joker, so I didn't know if you
oh, The
song.
Joker. Oh, yeah. I see.
It's
I see.
Actually the song. It's one of two Steve Miller Band songs that featured the incorrect word pompatus.
The pompatus of love.
Yeah, which isn't a word, because I speak on the pompatus of love. But I guess
I just didn't understand what they were really saying.
Yeah, I thought it was just some word that I didn't know, and I never thought to Google it. But it's actually a word that he misheard from another song, a Vernon Green song.
What an idiot.
And Vernon Green actually, the word that Vernon Green used, he actually makes it up. He made up the word called puppetoots, meaning a paper doll erotic fantasy figure. And Steve Miller misheard that word on a song and thought he said pompatus.
What an idiot. Why would you put that in your song if you didn't even know what the word was? So he just made up the spelling and everything?
I guess.
Because you'd find out it doesn't exist the minute you try to look it up to find out how to spell it.
Well, why would he look it up? Google didn't exist then. He's not going to go look
there's dictionaries.
You think he's going to go look in a dictionary?
If you're going to write a formal song and have like the lyrics and the jacket and
he's
all that.
Steve fucking Miller.
I don't care for that song anyways.
I'm a joker. I'm a toker.
Yeah.
I'm a midnight
toker. You already fucked it up.
I must have.
It's a joker, a smoker, a
smoker,
midnight
toker. Midnight toker, okay. You're the cutest thing that
right.
I ever
all right.
did
all right, all right, all right.
Really love your Stop peaches, it. Wanna shake your tree. Well, here's the thing. He wrote that under a peach tree.
What?
When somebody came by and shook it.
No, you're making some shit up now.
And he was
now.
Like, oh, I really love your peaches, wanna
all
shake
All right,
okay,
what's
that's
next?
That's not true. But that song, no, this is a little trivia about that song.
No, now you're gonna make some other shit up.
No, this is actually true.
I can tell.
No, this is true. It's not about him. It's more about me and how that song is only meaningful to me because when I got my first car in high school that I could only afford to buy because I was in a horrible car accident.
Yeah.
And Jim Jaco was driving his insurance, gave me money, so I was able to buy a car with that
Jeez.
Money.
Jeez.
So otherwise I wouldn't have had a car in high school, but I bought a Ford Tempo.
Mm-hmm.
There was a tape in the
nobody
tape.
Nobody cares
that,
about all this
yeah,
stuff
nobody cares
history
about that.
With your car.
Steve Miller Band.
So
the
you
Joker.
Had you had to listen to that all the time?
Yeah, it was the only tape in there. And they told me this was the car of the wife of the guy who owns the dealership.
Okay.
Which was a Ford Tempo, so why would he not give her something better?
I know, really.
It was a Ford dealership, so what do you want? And then Jane Goodall had another chimpanzee.
She did.
War. No, I'm just kidding. Sunday, January 13th, 1974, was the Super Bowl. All Super right. Bowl 8.
All right. What do we got to hear about this?
But the pause was because I was reading the Roman numerals.
Oh.
And, yeah, I always have to take a minute. Like, see how many little lines there are.
At least you can. I don't think our children.
V-I-I-I.
I don't think they just, they.
Well, why would you teach them? Why do you teach? Why does anybody?
Because so you can read shit like that.
So you can read the Super Bowl, what Super Bowl it is. That's
or whatever
reason.
It is. You can read, there's clocks that still have Roman numerals on them.
You're a clock. You want to guess what the Super Bowl ad price was?
Oh, God. I don't think we did it in 73, did we?
We did it in the first episode of 73.
We
did. Now that we spread it out in three episodes.
I can't remember what it was. What is it, like 800,000? 850,000?
No, remember, we went jump back to the 70s.
Oh, I thought it was already 600,000. Or maybe I'm thinking of 16,000. Maybe it was that low.
No.
I have no idea. Just
We were at the, like 80 grand.
Oh, it was 85,000.
That's at 103.
Okay.
103,000.
That was thrilling.
Yeah.
<that's> Go thrilling. Through all those numbers.
You know, I should start looking up the Super Bowl actual ads and like read them.
Popular Super Bowl, popular commercials from the years.
Oh, why didn't we do that?
Why didn't we do that, honey?
Why don't we do that?
Why
don't
we
well, we
do
got
it?
Time
okay.
to do we it
gotta,
the next
we
episode.
We should have done that. We should have done that in the 80s.
Oh, we should have done that in the 80s.
Oh, let's go back to the 80s.
We're idiots.
Let's start over.
Let's start over.
Okay. Nobody, welcome to 1980.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to American Timeline, the podcast that brings you a bunch of stupid shit that you don't want to listen to. Okay. Anyway, it was the Super Bowl was the Minnesota Vikings.
Oh.
And the crappy Miami Dolphins. The Dolphins, they won the game.
Oh, the Dolphins won.
24-7.
Imagine that.
Yeah, Vikings have never won a Super Bowl. They
imagine
lost.
Imagine that.
Lost four. This was the second consecutive Super Bowl for the stupid Dolphins. The first team to do so since the Green Bay Packers and Super Bowls 1 and 2. And the first AFL-AFC team to do so.
Okay.
It was at Rice Stadium in Houston, Texas. And this was the first time the Super Bowl was the Super Bowl venue was not home to that of an NFL franchise.
Oh, okay.
This is the last Super Bowl to feature goalposts at the front of the end zone. They were moved to the back of the end zone the next season.
Okay. I have no idea what the fuck that means.
You know how, like... I know
where the goalpost is.
You know how the goalpost, like where the kick is in the back of the end zone there? Yeah, like when they run, they touch down Randy Moss, they put his butt up against the one time the one guy hit it. It used to be, stupidly, at the front of the end zone. So when you run, there's a good chance you're going to hit it because it's like to get to the end zone, you got to get past the goal. You got to go around the goalpost in the middle.
Okay.
So people were hitting it and bumping into it all the time. And
so it's like in the middle of the football field?
Kind of like, no. The middle of the field's here, but here's the end zone. It was in the front of the end zone instead of the back of the end zone.
Okay.
The back of the end zone, you can run into the end zone anywhere to score.
Yeah.
But a lot of times people would hit that damn goalpost.
Okay. Well, good thing they figured that out.
Yeah, it was stupid that they did that. And do you want to know who sang the national anthem?
No.
Charlie Pride did.
Is that country singer?
Charlie Pride.
I think that's a country singer.
He's a prideful fella. I think he's saying, I don't know what Charlie Pride did. I guess I got to look up his bio. Guess I got to find
out. Not right now, you're not going to.
Charlie Pride, we got to find out.
No.
Right now. Yeah, we know.
What's next?
Also that, remember that Connie Hamsey who slept with all those dudes? Groupie?
Yep.
She probably banged Charlie Pride too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good thing we brought her back up for that.
Saturday, January 19th, 1974, we got a new number one song. Al Wilson takes over the Billboard charts.
Al Wilson? Who is that?
Al Wilson? You don't know who he is?
No.
No.
What a kind of a singer name is that?
Al Wilson?
I'm Al Wilson. It's not like your neighbor.
Well, I do have a neighbor named Al Wilson. He gives... You know, he can't...
Keeps mooning you every time you drive by.
Well, he... That, And every time he mows the lawn, it's a different spot. Like, where does your yard end and where does mine?
Yeah,
how come last time, Al, you stopped mowing here and I had to mow this part, and then this time you mowed farther over?
Are you,
so
is
that's
this
fine,
a euphemism for trimming your pubes?
Well.
Is this a big, big metaphorical story about him and you and you're trimming each other's pubes again?
You show me somebody who hasn't trimmed their neighbor's pubes, and I'll show you a guy with a lot of skin tags and a gross gut.
Touche.
Anyway, Al Wilson sang a song called Show and Tell.
I probably know it if you play it.
I don't want to show and tell.
No, that's not how it goes.
Yeah.
Idiot.
Idiot?
You're an idiot.
That's harsh.
Play that. Sing that song.
No, it is. Terrence Trent D'Arby and Al Wilson are the same guy. Not without a wish it well, and it well.
You don't
show
even...
and tell, and a show and tell.
All right.
Al Wilson, Show and Tell. Actually, I don't know the song at all. I don't think I've ever heard it.
Yeah, that's some old R&B.
I don't know who Al Wilson is, but I bet he got a lot of ladies.
He got a lot of puss.
A lot of puss. I was going to say trim, but then I stopped myself because I didn't want to. It's the Me Too movement, and then you went ahead and just went with the puss.
Yeah.
So, but you can because you are a lady. Yeah. This was first recorded, according to Wikipedia, this was first recorded by Johnny Mathis in 1972, but this one went to number one in 1974 with Al Wilson. Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yes.
Covered this.
Engelbert Humperdinck.
Peebo Bryson did it. Had a number one R&B hit with his version in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Vanessa Williams, the singer. Because there's two Vanessa Williams, covered the song for her 2005 studio album Everlasting Love, and
so there's a lot of R&B lovers that were probably totally cussing us out when we were talking about Al Wilson and stuff.
They're like,
probably like,
"You
idiots,
you stupid pieces of shit that don't know this." The song was often pulled by Paul Schaefer and the CBS Orchestra on the Late Show with David Letterman for the segment Show and Tell.
Mm-hmm.
Dave had that set up. Yeah, so. There you go.
Yep.
Engelbert Humperdinck. There was a wrestling manager by that name, I think.
No.
Yeah,
no.
Same name. No. Oh, it was Oliver Humperdinck.
I was going to say.
So anytime I hear Engelbert Humperdinck, I just picture that guy. He was like a fat guy with a red beard. And then Saturday, January 26, 1974... Al Wilson is now off the number one spot, and Ringo Starr has replaced him with a song that I find very controversial and and wrong. Like, again, it's back into this whole raping children thing.
Okay.
That we write songs about having sex with children, and everybody just accepts it, and that's fine.
What is
now,
that?
I was wrong. Ben was about a mouse. It was a movie about a mouse.
Yeah, okay.
A rat or whatever. So I realized that, but... If you hadn't known that, it would sound like Michael Jackson singing about a love affair with an old man. But this one, Ringo Starr, the song is called You're 16.
You're 16.
You know that song?
I think.
You're 16
it sounds
in
like
your
a
mind?
50s song.
Like it is a 50 song that he redid.
Yeah, I know that song.
But still, why didn't anybody in the 50s, why didn't they think that was wrong? Like, a grown man singing about...
The a lot of times who was singing were teenagers, too.
No, it's a grown man singing this.
But a lot of people covered it, I think.
You must have been able to date 16-year-olds when you're 16, you're beautiful in your mind.
Yeah. Peaches and cream. Yeah. Strawberry wine. Because they sing it, honey.
And then I thought
singer,
it was like maybe somebody singing about his daughter.
No, the singers that are singing it are singing it with their fans in mind. And their fans are all teenagers. And so they're going to sing songs that appeal to teenagers because they're the ones listening.
But then he talks about kissing them.
Yeah, so they're thinking about their fans. So if there's a boy who would listen to the song and imagine himself singing it to his girlfriend. I mean, they're making the songs for the fans to enjoy.
Well, in the video, it's Ringo Starr, a fully grown man with a beard, he made a video of it where he's singing this to a 16-year-old girl, and he's like kissing her.
Well, that's weird. It's played by
Carrie Fisher.
What?
Yeah, in the video.
Oh. Okay, we can turn it off.
I'm gonna kiss you. I'm gonna.
It's a dumb song.
Put it in you and all this stuff.
No, they don't say that. No.
Yeah, they do. They say horrible things. But here's the thing. So this song, Paul McCartney is credited on the liner notes as having played the solo on a kazoo.
Okay.
There's a kazoo solo in this song. Jeez. Which, again, why
sounds
was
like
this?
A winner.
Yeah. But I guess it wasn't really a kazoo. It just sounds like a kazoo. But who cares? So let's not go on and on about the kazoo.
Let's not go on and on about the song. How about that?
Yeah. Carrie Fisher was 22 when she was in the video, so at least she wasn't 16. But in 2017, the song was connected to the Roy Moore controversy.
Oh.
Remember the whole Roy Moore thing? And yeah. They talked about him wanting to date high school girls when he was in his 20s. And he'd go to high school football games, pick up 16-year-olds. Breitbart editor Joel Pollack, during an interview on CNN, said, you know, in 1973, Ringo Starr hit number one on the Billboard charts with the song You're 16, You're Beautiful in Your Mind. And your mind, Pollack said, he was like 30-something, singing about a 16-year-old. You want to take away Ringo Starr's achievement? And so he was saying that.
So he's saying Ringo Starr is just as bad for singing a song.
Right. Well, he's saying
as
about
Roy Moore is, who's actually going out and doing these things.
Yeah.
That's a ridiculous comparison.
Well, why would you sing about banging a 16-year-old? That just is weird.
It is not anywhere close to actually doing what Roy Moore did.
Okay. Well, I'm not saying that. The guy from Breitbart said that.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm just saying it's a stupid comparison.
I only watch InfoWars like 4 times a week.
Gross.
Like fat
guy. I would be leaving you.
Sometimes I see that guy and I'm like, God, do I look like that guy?
Sometimes I see that guy and think, why isn't he in a cardiac unit somewhere?
Oh, he will be. Yeah. He's going to have a heart attack. He's got to eat.
He looks like he's having one every time I see him.
Does he have two hammocks in it? Two ham?
What?
Ham hocks in his hands? Like, I feel like he's under the table. He's just going to take two bites of giant
hammock. Yeah.
Anyway, Friday, February 1st, 1974, Connect Four was introduced.
Oh, one of my toys.
Connect Four went on sale.
Mm-hmm.
It was also known as Captain's Mistress, Four Up, Plot Four, Find Four, Four in a Row, Four in a Line, Drop Four, and Gravitrips.
And it also has Pretty Sneaky Sis. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, and then she punches him in the face. It's a two-player connection game in which the players first choose a color and then take turn. We all know what Connect Four is.
Right. We don't need to.
I just played that with Jack Marshall not recently.
What?
We went to a bar. They had. Yeah. But I don't know if you know this. Connect Four is a solved game. The first player can always win by playing the right moves.
Yeah, I can figure that. It's not. I mean, it's a pretty easy. It's like playing tic-tac-toe, isn't it?
Yeah, except there's a lot more circles.
Yeah.
A lot more holes. But Jack
that's
and I.
That's what
just,
she said.
Jack and I, we nobody won. We just tied every single game.
Yeah. That's.
But we also didn't have enough pieces.
Oh. Because you're at a bar.
You're at a bar that has the game. So. We played it at Third Coast Comedy Club in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay.
They have improv shows and comedy shows. Yeah, it was a good time. They had a good beer selection. I drank a Bearded Iris.
Mm hmm.
IPA from a brewery called Bearded Iris. It was delicious.
All right.
I like to go to other cities and try their beers.
All right. Enough about you.
It wasn't about me. It was about Nashville. Shout out to Nashville and Matt Ruck.
Okay.
Matt Ruck lives there. He's a beautiful fella.
What's next?
And then Connect Four was invented again.
No.
And then more people played Connect Four. Let's just do a Connect Four podcast.
No, we're not doing that.
Connect Four.
We're not doing that.
Saturday, February 2nd, 1974, Barbra Streisand comes on the top of the Billboard charts.
Oh, was it?
This is a song from a movie from last episode that we talked about briefly.
Was it? Enough is enough is enough. fucking go on.
It was the title of the movie.
Oh, it's a title. I can't remember.
The Way We Were.
Oh, okay. The Way We Were. She's so...
Are you a fan of that song?
I know that song.
You know it.
I'm not a big Barbara Streisand fan.
I loathe it.
I
loathe Barbara Streisand.
That's a strong feeling. I can't. Don McAllister's going to have your head on a platter.
For somebody like, I really love Don McAllister, but we have nothing in common at all.
Nothing.
No, the only thing we have in common, Don and I, is alcohol. Yeah. We both love to drink.
That's all that matters.
It is all that matters.
That's all it takes.
Because he is a bar, like, he goes home and he just plays Barbara Streisand songs and movies and dresses up like Barbara Streisand.
He doesn't dress up like Barbara Streisand.
And makes soup in his apartment and songs and dances around, probably.
No, he doesn't.
If I never hear the song again, it'll be too damn soon.
Yeah, okay.
It sucks. It's terrible. She's awful. Like, why would you, like, what is appealing about that, her voice or anything? It's just, I don't get it. I just don't. Get it.
That's why you're straight man.
I guess if you want to just lump people in categories.
I see how you are.
I don't see gender, so I'm not sure that I'm a straight man. I don't even know that I'm a man. I don't see gender. I don't see race. I don't see color. I don't see sex.
What's next?
No, but let me tell you about the way we were.
Okay.
Oh, God, does anybody care about any of this?
No.
It helped. Apparently, this song helped revive her career. It was like struggling before this, apparently. But and now she won't even like play all cities in the country. Like she wouldn't dare set foot in a lot of states because she's too good for everybody. But this was the most. It's sad to say. The Way We Were was 1974's most successful recording in the United States.
Was it really?
Yeah. Isn't that terrible?
Well, a lot of sentimental people.
Why do people like that? It's so dumb.
All right.
And shitty.
Can we move on now?
It's just...
You made your point.
It's just... No, Marvin Hamlisch wrote that song, by the way. Marvin Hamlisch. Mm-hmm. The only thing I know about Marvin Hamlisch is he's got a funny name.
Yeah, that's true.
I like that name. But, I got to a point where I listened to the song, and I think I just lost all faith in humanity, and at the same time, I realized, well, this is why we have wars and strife, because this, like, people like this, so what's
the
point?
It's not that bad. Wars and strife. What's wrong with you?
No, I mean, this is why the world is the way it is, because there are people who like that.
That's so silly.
I'm sorry, I just...
All right, what's next?
I've lost all hope in humanity.
The Yup Charlotte podcast connects you with your great local businesses. The podcast includes events, reviews, and interviews featuring the people and businesses that make Charlotte NC the vibrant... dynamic city it is.
The bi-weekly show is hosted by Yelp Charlotte Senior Community and Marketing Director Nikki Wolf. And recent guests have included former Carolina Panthers Steve Ice Up Son Smith and Heather McDonald from Cup Crazed.
Find out who's making things happen in Charlotte with the Yelp Charlotte podcast.
Good job. Thanks.
Bye.
Now it's your turn, I think. It's time for your... Okay. Your stupid crap or whatever it is.
My stupid crap or whatever it is.
Your stupid murder story where you're going to talk about children being raped and murdered and bloodied and faces being ripped off.
No.
By chimpanzees.
All right. In 1974.
Yes.
A group of left-wing radicals calling themselves the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Oh, the SLA.
Stormed into the Berkeley, California apartment of publishing heiress Patty Hearst. And after smashing a wine bottle across her fiancé's face, dragged her away into the night. Who these people were and what happened to their victim after they ran off with her has since become the stuff of American legend.
This is a big one. This is a big one and I can't wait to hear about this because I've always heard this name. Mm-hmm. And I've heard this as a reference, but I've never really delved into it or known exactly what.
Well, hold on to your tits because here we go. In the space of just a few months, a wealthy white woman from a famous family was abducted, converted to revolutionary Maoism, started making videos denouncing her own father as a pig, and then joined her comrades in a series of violent bank robberies.
I think we need more high-profile kidnappings.
Later, when a third of her fellow revolutionaries died in a shootout with police on live TV, the manhunt for Patty Hearst occupied daily media coverage and finally ended with Comrade Tanya, as she now called herself, being captured and charged for her crimes.
Oh, she changed her name.
So this is the story of Patty Hearst kidnapping.
Yes.
In 1973, a small group of young, radical, self-proclaimed anti-fascists in California...
Antifa.
...founded the Symbionese Liberation Army. Most were former Berkeley students, like Nancy Ling, who came from an upper-middle-class family in San Francisco. She got an English degree in 1967.
When you say Symbionese...
Symbionese.
Symbionese. What is that? What's Symbian?
I'll tell you. It'll come up.
Can you explain that? Okay.
In 1973, she was working at an orange juice stand on the Berkeley campus.
Selling orange juice?
She also dealt blackjack topless at a tourist attraction in San Francisco.
Topless.
Blackjack.
Topless blackjack dealer selling orange juice on the side of the road.
Would that be good naked or bad naked?
That would be good naked.
You think? To deal blackjack?
I mean, if she's juggling while she's doing it, maybe a bit bad, but it's like, you know, but you and I have different opinions on good naked versus bad naked. I think there's not, like, for ladies, there's not much bad. For guys, like, almost everything they're doing is bad naked.
All right. So the next, another one was Camilla Hall. She was a social worker from Minnesota who had quit her job and
Camilla
moved to
Hall,
Berkeley.
Y'all. She's a social worker.
Where she lived off her family's trust fund and wrote radical poetry as well as created line drawings that she tried to sell on the street.
Well, maybe if she had to work a couple days in her life, she wouldn't. But if she was a social worker, that's hard work.
But she left that. She quit her job and moved to Berkeley.
She went into social work thinking it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
But then once she got a job, she was like, no, this is hard work. I ain't doing this because I'm going to live off my family. With money, and so I'm going to be a radical, crazy person because I don't know what it's like to live for a dollar.
Another typical member of the group was Willie Wolf, the son of an anesthesiologist from Connecticut, who had graduated from a Massachusetts prep school in 1967 and went to Berkeley to study anthropology.
Wait, this is an anesthesiologist?
His son. Son of an anesthesiologist.
Oh, son of an anesthesiologist.
So while he was visiting prison inmates for a class... Wolf, who had started calling himself Cujo, met a radical black bank robber named Donald DeFries.
Oh, now that guy sounds cool.
Who would soon become the leader of the fledgling SLA.
Oh.
You're just going to skim over that this guy started calling himself Cujo? On that?
Well, I mean, that's a badass name. I mean, I would call myself Cujo, too, if I was a rabid dog. But now, he was the son of a...
Anesthesiologist.
But tell me more about this DeFries fellow.
All right.
He's the one who sounds cool to me.
He called himself General Marshall Sink Mutembe. He escaped from Soledad State Prison on March 5th, 1973.
Mm-hmm. You mean the same day Tim Conway and Sha Na Na were on the new Bill Cosby show?
Yes.
And that's the same day that last year we talked about those New York Yankees pitchers that swapped their wives. Mm-hmm. That's the day they announced they were swapping their wives. They had that press conference where they said, hey, we're wife swapping. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Oh, that's the same day.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, that works.
So that was happening in society.
Bill Cosby has a lot of skin tags.
On his face.
On his face.
Are those skin tags or is that something else?
I don't know, but it's gross.
Well... Maybe if he didn't have those, he wouldn't have to drug women and rape them.
All right. We're moving on.
Well, Tim Conway and Sha Na Na were on the new Bill Cosby show, and while Sha Na Na was performing, Bill Cosby was probably...
Yes, he probably was.
...raping someone.
Okay. So he escaped from his prison on this date by just walking away from a work detail.
What?
There was just one guard there who left.
One idiot
left
guard?
Left him there.
He quit his job that day?
I don't know. He just left. And so he just walked away, and he entered his...
Sometimes I think about that. What if a prisoner, I had a job once that I just walked away. I just left and I never went back.
Yeah.
What if a prison guard decided to do that one day, and he's out, got like 25 prisoners out in the yard somewhere?
So then he went into the Symbionese SLA.
The SLA, y'all.
They put him in safe houses. They sheltered him from police. And then he started writing manifestos. And he designed the SLA's seven-headed cobra symbol.
Wait, hold on. Say what? So he got out of prison. He escaped from prison. And then he started doing what?
He was in safe houses.
Where did he find these safe houses?
The SLA members. All these white girls and rich kids.
Yeah, these white rich kids.
They sheltered him.
Yeah.
And hid him. And he started writing manifestos. And then he came up with the symbol for the SLA.
Yeah, that was
And then he came up with the name. And it's from, he liked the word symbiotic.
Yeah.
And then he.
So that's where he got
Symbionese from.
So it's not even a. Yeah. Sounds like it's a country or somewhere.
No, it does.
And they. Yeah, so the logo is like a seven-headed snake or something?
Seven-headed cobra.
Seven-headed cobra, so it's kind of like, it's Hydra, Hail Hydra. Yeah, it's Hail Hydra.
Stupid. It's pretty stupid if you think about it.
Probably got out of a comic book.
So the manifestos and other assorted writings offered little in the way of a clear mission statement.
Sure.
Death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people, read one communique, widely offered up as the group's motto.
I actually like that one.
Otherwise, according to the New York Times, the group's splintered rhetoric on cultural, racial, and sexual oppression was nearly random. Huh. But on August 21st, they released a declaration of war against the United States.
It's weird that they would declare war on the United States the same time the Teamsters Union and the AFL-CIO's United Farm Workers Union came to a settlement with regard to organizing grape growers in California.
Oh, okay. That's kind of a historical thing.
Yeah, in response, Cesar Chavez called an end to the UFW grape strike. There was a grape strike. It was a nationwide boycott of California's non-union grapes, lettuce, and Gallo wines was stepped up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good.
So the same time as that was happening, they declared war
on the United States. And the success of the Castro Revolution in Cuba served as their model.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Whatever the purported philosophy of the Symbionese Liberation Army, their actions under DeFreeze turned violent starting in 1973.
See, that's where you lose me, the violence.
When they killed Marcus Foster, Oakland's first black school superintendent.
Oh, that's bullshit.
I know.
You can't kill Marcus Foster.
You idiots.
What the fuck are you doing? You had a good idea, and then you just go kill Marcus Foster?
Yep.
Why would you kill him?
They said it was for his fascist support of making school children in the district carry ID cards.
Oh, God.
So they killed him on November 6th, 1973.
Just for making kids have IDs?
Yeah.
Poor Marcus Foster. He's doing a good thing.
And
he's breaking the glass ceiling.
He was very popular with the left and with the black community.
Marcus Foster was?
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, it turned out after they killed him, it turned out he had opposed the ID card plan.
Oh, he wasn't even, the whole reason they killed him was not the reason.
Yeah, so presumably they didn't know when they shot him into him eight times with hollow point .45 caliber bullets that they had filled up with cyanide beforehand.
It seems like they're just, here's what it is, they're fucking idiots.
Yes, they are idiots, yep. And so that killing had other radicals in the area wondering what the SLA was thinking. So the left and people are turning against them.
You're making it hard to be a radical, you dumbass.
Yep. So by the end of 1973, with the Foster killing still in the papers, the SLA decided to really grab some headlines by kidnapping Patty Hearst, famed heiress to the fortune of publishing magnate William Randolph Hearst.
Right. Now, I think I read something somewhere where they said it really wasn't that much of a thought process behind it. It was like they were real close by. Like Patty Hearst lived like.
Well, I'll get to it.
Oh, okay.
So in 1973, Patty Hearst was mainly famous for being famous.
So she was like Paris Hilton.
Yes.
Or the Kardashians.
Yes, exactly.
Not famous for any skill or talent, just famous for being a famous rich person.
See, she occasionally appeared in the society section of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah.
While attending a Bay Area Catholic school, she reportedly lied to the nuns about her mother having cancer to get out of exams.
Oh, now that is just low.
According to a psychologist who later testified at her trial, she experimented with sex and drugs at an early age. In 1973, still just 18 and living on her own in an apartment a few blocks away from the Symbionese Liberation Army's hangout and studying art history at Berkeley, Patty Hearst paid a visit to Soledad State Prison, where, according to a private investigator...
named after Soledad O'Brien.
...hired after the kidnapping, she visited Donald DeFries, the soon-to-be General Field Marshal of the SLA.
She went to visit him in prison.
Yeah. Nobody knows how Hearst came to know DeFries or what they talked about when they met. Though prison staff unaccountably allowed DeFries virtually unlimited conjugal visits with women he wasn't married to, which is a violation of the rules that were in place at the time.
So you were only allowed to have conjugal visits to people you were married to?
Yeah.
Seems pretty harsh. So, but they let this guy bang whoever he wanted to.
So a few months before her kidnapping, Patty Hearst was written up in the local papers when her family announced her engagement to her 51-year-old tutor, Steve Weed.
Steve Weed is a 51-year-old tutor.
Yeah, and she's engaged to him.
And she's 18.
And her family put it in the newspaper.
Because they thought that was a good idea.
With their address.
Oh, God.
Her apartment address was written up in the newspaper. Printed in the newspaper.
Now, Steve Weed, I am picturing Steve Weed as this guy. You know, when he was in college, he was like, dude, I'm Steve Weed. I'm the hookup, you know. And like he was just like the cool dude, the smoking weed. But he wasn't because he's a tutor. So he wasn't that.
He's a nerdy guy.
You want Steve Weed to be the
skinny,
cool,
nerdy guy.
Skinny, nerdy, 51-year-old guy with an 18. You know, I think that's what Skid Row's song 18 in Life was based on this.
Oh,
18 in Life, you got it.
All right. 18. You're getting way off topic.
Probably
here.
Not. I don't know.
All right. So on February 4th, 1974... Patty and her fiancé were together in her apartment.
Wait, they were in her apartment probably getting ready to watch Bill Bixby in The Magician.
Okay.
I think we cut this out of the last show, but Bill Bixby before The Incredible Hulk was on a show called The Magician where he was a magician. It was the cases of a stage magician escape artist who moonlights as an amateur crime fighter. And they were like hour-long episodes about Bill Bixby.
Okay.
And on Monday, February 4th, this episode, he was performing on board of the Queen Mary.
Oh, you got all stuffed up for all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You all right?
On this episode, the magician is performing on board of the Queen Mary when masked robbers interrupt his act. And his friend Ed Cassidy, played by William Shatner, is blamed for the robbery. And Tony Blake sets out to prove his innocence.
Okay.
That show was on. They were about to watch it.
And she's only wearing a nightgown.
Oh, she's wearing a nightgown watching The Magician in bed.
So when a group of three Symbionese Liberation Army members burst through her door and grabbed her.
They bust in. And she's already met with this one guy. So she already has contact with him.
One of the kidnappers grabbed a bottle of wine that Hearst had been sharing with Weed and smashed it across his head, knocking him out.
Oh, no. And he's like, I'm never going to know how The Magician ends.
The group then bundled Hearst into the trunk of a waiting car, fired several rounds into the apartment building, and sped off.
Holy shit! She'll never know. And that show's going to be canceled soon. She'll never know the ending.
So 8 days later, the SLA released a statement threatening to execute their prisoner of war and demanding the release of Russell Little, one of the group's founders, who was then sitting in jail for the murder of the school superintendent. It was this letter that ended with the phrase that has widely come to define the group, death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people.
That's funny, because I actually have that as a tramp stamp, right?
Yeah, I know you do, yeah.
Right above my butt. Yeah.
At the time of her abduction, Patty Hearst was an affluent white woman who was seized in the most dramatic way a politically radical group of humanities students could arrange. Naturally, the incident was an instant hit with the media, which devoted acres of print to developments in the case and biographies of every known member of the SLA. According to her own later accounts, Patty Hearst spent much of her time locked in a closet at the SLA safe house, where she was subjected to Maoist consciousness-raising sessions and repeatedly raped by various members of the group.
Huh.
With Patty Hearst captive, the SLA used its newfound notoriety to the fullest. Right after the kidnapping, when Donald DeFries put out the statement demanding the release of Russell Little, the SLA also demanded that Hearst's rich father pay $70 to every needy person in California in the form of free groceries.
$70? That's it?
Yeah, and free groceries.
But the total of that, every
to every needy person in California.
Like hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably.
So Randolph Hearst, Patty Hearst's father, immediately took out a $2 million loan on February 19th.
Yeah.
And he gave the money to a group he hastily founded called People in Need.
While they're making the threats, before he took the money out, Blazing Saddles came out.
Oh, it did.
The number one movie of the year.
That's a great movie.
The number one highest grossing movie of the year anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they first screened that for Warner Brothers executives, almost nobody laughed. And the movie was not going to be released. And then Mel Brooks quickly set up another screening for studios employees. And those regular folks laughed uproariously throughout the movie. And they decided to take a chance on it. And so regular rich
it's
people.
A classic
like, yeah.
now.
Yep. And there is a man. If you look at around 1 hour and 27 minutes into the movie, there is a man in a sweater standing on the sidewalk watching the action in the background. They kept trying to get that guy to get out of the shot, but he kept wandering back into it. And they finally just kept him in it and had him sign a waiver, and he's in the movie.
No, funny.
And then while filming, Burton Gilliam, Lyle the henchman, was having a difficult time saying the N-word, especially to Cleavon Little, because they really like Cleavon Little.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, after several takes, Little took Gilliam off the side and he told him, it's okay because these aren't your words. And then Little jokingly added, if I thought you would say those words to me in any other situation, we'd go to Fist City. But this is all fun. Don't worry about it.
Oh, that's
good. I just love it because he said Fist City. And then February 9th, Love Unlimited Orchestra takes over the Billboard charts with Love's theme. It's an instrumental piece recorded by Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra. And it's like a disco. It's like one of the first ever disco. It was like a disco instrumental song.
Oh, okay.
And disco started like exploding popularity.
I didn't know Barry White did any instrumentals.
Yeah, apparently his. Well, it's his orchestra.
Okay.
Like I don't think he's on it at all.
Oh,
but
okay.
This is the orchestra played with him. And if you watch the video on YouTube, it's just a bunch of people like on Soul Train dancing.
Yeah, I can funny. Imagine it.
You just picture it. And then real quick, we're almost to February 19th, February 17th. A U.S. soldier, Robert K. Preston, stole a helicopter from Fort Meade in Maryland and flew to the White House in Washington, D.C. and hovered over the White House. And the Secret Service shot and injured him, forcing him to land.
What was he doing?
He received a one-year prison sentence and $2,400 in fines. Basically, he was in the Army trying to become a helicopter pilot, and he failed.
Oh.
The test.
So he was pissed?
So he was just trying to prove that he could fly a helicopter. So he flew it over
the White House?
Over the White House, yeah.
What an idiot. What
a dumbass. And they shot him down. Like, they shot him down, and he was fine. But luckily,
he could have died.
Yeah. Nixon wasn't there. He was gone, and Nixon's wife was visiting his...
God, what an idiot.
Her sick daughter. He was kind of a crazy person. So
I guess so.
And then on February 19th, the same night as the first American Music Awards, and Maud was on.
Yeah.
The Investment.
Okay. Yes.
Maud's a great show.
So he took out the $2 million loan and gave the money to a group he hastily founded, People in Need. His good intentions came to grief, however, and the program to give away food had to be shut down when the needy people located the giveaway operation in West Oakland and started a riot that sent several people to the hospital.
Oh, gosh. So all the needy people. So I like the idea of the needy people getting stuff.
Yeah, but then there was so many people that the people that were in the building, they started throwing the food out the window at the poor people, and
oh,
then
no.
the poor people
are fighting over it,
getting pissed, and they start throwing the food back in the window.
Oh, wait, they're throwing the food back because they're mad at them throwing in the food?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Oh. And then they started a riot.
Oh, no.
So
I thought they were fighting over, like, there'd be, like, no. poor people fighting over bread and stuff.
No, so at various points, Patty Hearst made audio recordings that were then released to the media. The first two, made on days 9 and 13 of her captivity, were of the usual I'm okay but do what they want variety. Then on day 34, after the riot and the suspension of the food giveaway, the tone shifted. Here's a transcript of that third recording. Hold on.
So she's still, they still don't know where she is, but
no,
she's just setting out recordings.
Quote, Mom, Dad, I've been hearing reports about the food program. So far it sounds like you and your advisors have managed to turn it into a real disaster. You said that it was out of your hands. What you should have said was that you washed your hands of it. It sounds like most of the food is low quality. No one received any beef or lamb. Anyway, it certainly doesn't sound like the kind of food our family is used to eating.
Lamb? So she was just yelling at them,
picky about the food because they're
not giving
away.
Them fancy food.
So honest criticism, perhaps. But then on day 59, she recorded this next one. Quote, oh, Mom, Dad, tell the poor and oppressed people of this nation what the corporate state is about to do. Warn black and poor people that they are about to be murdered down to the last man, woman, and child. Tell the people that the energy crisis is nothing more than a means to get public approval for a massive program to build nuclear power plants all over the nation. I've been given the choice of one, being released in a safe area, or two, joining the forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army and fighting for my freedom and the freedom of all oppressed people. I have chosen to stay and fight. I've been given the name Tanya after a comrade who fought alongside Che in Bolivia.
Well, Tanya's a nice name.
It is
name.
In the spirit of Tanya that I say, Patrio o muerta veneceremos.
Oh, I know what that means. That means stand clear of the doors on the subway.
Yeah, no,
I've
that's,
seen that on there.
That's Menti de la Puerta, something. I used to remember. I used to have that memorized.
Mentengasi a la. Yeah, I recognize Puerta.
Yeah, de la Puerta. As if to dispel any doubts about whether she was serious, on April 15th.
On Monday, April 15th, the same day the magician was on again.
Oh, okay.
And this time with Bill Bixby, a magician was killed. A fellow magician was killed during the filming of a highly risky magic trick. And so Bill Bixby takes on both the investigation and his friend's place in recreating the Table of Death illusion for the cameras.
Okay, who cares?
I can't believe that show was canceled. Bill Bixby is a magician.
All right, so on April 15th, she was caught on CCTV waving a gun around and guarding hostages during an SLA bank robbery. When general bungling led to shots being fired, leaving one person dead and another injured, the group fired the bank. They fled the bank and disappeared, taking $10,692 with them.
Surprising there's no change. They didn't even take a quarter.
Then the authorities received this message. Quote, greetings to the people. This is Tanya. Our actions of April 15th forced the corporate state to help finance the revolution. As for being brainwashed, the idea is ridiculous beyond belief. I'm a soldier in the people's army.
Tanya. What a funny name. You know anybody named Tanya?
One of my mom's best friends was named Tanya.
Like growing up?
Mm-hmm.
Tanya. Like every Tanya I've ever met, it's just kind of like, you know, she's not going to lead anything. She's just like, Tanya's coming over. I got to talk to her about her boyfriend.
Yeah.
Get some cookies.
So the end of the Symbionese Liberation Army began a month after the bank robbery when Patty Hearst, now known as Tanya, accompanied a couple other members to Mel's Sporting Goods store in Los Angeles. As SLA members William Harris and his wife Emily were about to pay for their supplies and leave, Harris tried shoplifting an ammunition case. When the pair were confronted by store security, they forced their way to the front of the store where Hearst pulled a gun and shot up the store sign.
Oh.
She had been taught to shoot by her father, by the way.
Oh, okay. Her dad, who was happy with her marrying a 55-year-old guy named Weed.
Yep. That Steve got the LAPD's attention, and they put out an APB for the van that the SLA members fled in.
Calling all cars. The van's fleeing a sporting goods store. They shot up a sign. And
you can just picture that 70s van pulling off, probably green.
Yeah, green van with like those like black circle windows some kind of 70s design on it.
Maybe. So the van's later spotted in front of a small house on 54th Street, which was immediately surrounded by hundreds of police officers.
This is in L.A., right?
Yeah. Over the next several hours, more than 9,000 rounds of ammunition crossed each other in the air as the SLA and LAPD traded gunfire.
9,000
So it was a
rounds?
Total gun battle.
Holy cow.
And the residents fled the now blocked off neighborhood, and half the whole country tuned into local news, which broadcast the event live.
This is
the
crazy.
Whole shootout was on TV live.
I never heard about all this. This is the 70s, man. Yeah. 70s are crazy.
As the siege went on, one member of the SLA was fatally wounded by a shot through the wall, and two more were killed as they tried to flee out the back. When police fired scores of gunpowder actuated tear gas canisters through the window, starting a massive fire that quickly engulfed the whole place.
Oh, no.
General Marshal Cinque Mutembe of the People's Symbionese Liberation Army led his two surviving followers into a crawl space under the house. Their corpses were later found with their gas masks melted to their faces.
Oh, snap.
This was one of the greatest gun battles in U.S. history.
Really?
Yeah.
In the U.S. history?
That's not a war.
Yeah, well, I guess. I mean, I'm just thinking like the Wild West and everything. Stuff, yeah. But I guess they just have those tiny little six shooters or whatever. They're not going to have a 9,000 rounds being blasted through there.
It might not be now, but at the time it was. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, I guess. But
there's probably more.
I don't think more than this. I mean, this is a lot.
Yeah. Through it all, the only question anybody cared about and the one that the media kept bringing up was whether or not Patty Hearst was in the house. As it happens, she wasn't.
She wasn't there.
She had separated from the rest of her group and gone to a different safe house and watched the siege on TV like everyone else.
Oh, really?
After it was over and all six SLA members' deaths were confirmed, Comrade Tanya released her last public statement as an urban revolutionary on June 7th.
Oh, gosh.
And I know we're getting through the year, but...
Yeah, on June 7th, 1974. Oh, the same day that Jeanette Nolan and Dak Rambo...
Mm-hmm.
Jeanette Nolan and Dak Rambo starred in Dirty Sally. It was a TV show about a crotchety old lady, Sally Fergus, who roams the Old West with a young companion, Cyrus.
That sounds bad.
It only lasted one season.
Yeah, it sounds pretty bad.
It looks stupid.
So here's what she wrote. Quote, "Greetings to the people. This is Tanya. I want to talk about the way I knew our six murdered comrades because the fascist pig media have, of course, been painting a typically distorted picture of these beautiful sisters and brothers."
Fake
then
news.
She goes on and talks about each one that died and what how great they were stuff. And all
you
that
don't
stuff.
Have to go into all that.
And then
are we sure it's not Tanya?
She said she had her love affair with Cujo, that he was her true soulmate.
He was?
True magic love Cujo and all this
was?
Stuff, yeah. What she had to do, apparently, she said at the end, "I know what I have to do." And what she had to do was rob another bank. And on April 18th, 1975, in Sacramento, where more careless gunplay by a different SLA member.
Did you say Mork careless?
No.
Mork?
More careless gunplay.
Oh.
Hold on.
Mork airless.
Got a 42-year-old woman making a deposit for her church shot in the chest with a 12-gauge shotgun.
Oh, shit.
Then on August 22nd, 1975, so this has gone on for...
Yeah, we're in the next year. We're already in the next episode. We're in like episode 40-something at this point, and I didn't even do any dates on this.
I know.
You just gotta go.
A man found a black bag in the parking lot of an IHOP.
Oh, he delicious IHOP. Oh, this is the IHOP murderer.
He was getting ready to kick it.
He was going to kick that bag?
He was going to kick it.
There's a black bag.
Why would you think?
Well, I'm in an IHOP parking lot.
There's a black bag.
And there's a black bag.
I guess I'll kick it.
I guess I'll kick that shit. I guess I'm going to kick it.
I'm going to kick it.
I know. Actually, I think I relate to that guy.
Would you kick it? Oh, you know.
Here's the thing. Listen. You got
a bomber, baby. Either way, let's just kick it.
put yourself in the situation. You're in 1975.
Yeah.
You're in an IHOP parking lot. Why wouldn't you kick a black bag?
Well, inside of it was one of the most dangerous pipe bombs the bomb squad had ever seen.
Oh.
It was placed beneath a car. But when the car pulled away.
The bag was sitting there.
It didn't go off. It had missed by a 16th of an inch.
Oh no.
Then so these two police officers are driving away. They hear about the bomb found in the parking lot over their whatever thing and realize they
you
just
You mean
had,
their walkie-talkies?
Yeah. They realize, "Well, we just left that IHOP." So then they're like, "Oh shit, let's
And
oh,
that
shit.
Was a delicious meal we had.
They,
but let's go
they're
back."
Like, no, they're like, "Oh shit, let's look under our car and make sure that and sure enough the other half of the bomb was still on the
They
bottom
were trying
of
to kill those guys.
Cart.
Oh.
Yep. And then they also found another bomb discovered in another police car as
what?
Well. But that didn't go off
that
either.
That didn't go off either?
No, these guys, they're pretty piss poor as revolutionaries so far. Their plans
kinda
seem
like the
to
mag,
foil
like the,
all
like
the time.
Like the MAGA bomber. And then his went off.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, but he didn't kill anybody.
Yeah, he did.
The MAGA bomber?
The Unabomber.
I'm talking about the MAGA bomber.
Oh,
the most recent
oh,
guy.
Oh, no, okay. I'm sorry.
This new
I don't
guy.
Know anything about that.
Oh, he's this new guy.
Yeah, you told me about him, but I don't know.
In the news, he's a big Trump guy, and he's trying to kill Obama and Clinton and everybody.
So ridiculous. So authorities followed a trail that eventually led them to Hearst's apartment in the Mission District in San Francisco, where she was arrested on September 19th, 1975, 17 months after the kidnapping.
Wow.
When she was booked, Patty Hearst gave her occupation as urban gorilla.
Guerrilla. Not gorilla, right?
But isn't that ridiculous?
Urban gorilla.
All right. While her parents spent whatever was necessary to hire investigators, psychologists and F. Lee Bailey as her defense counsel.
Trying to get people to say she was brainwashed.
A defiant Hearst refused to cooperate with the investigators or to speak with her pig fascist family.
Really?
The psychiatrists that examined her said she weighed 87 pounds and had lost 18 IQ points.
Oh, what? Oh, so she lost a lot of weight and IQ points.
However, with serious charges and likely prison time ahead of her, she underwent a rapid deconversion and renounced as rapists and brainwashers the people she had described with words and phrases like wise and the gentlest, most beautiful man I'd ever known.
No, so now they're trying to prove she had Munchausen syndrome, right?
No, Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm syndrome. Munchausen is where you
poison. Where you pretend like you're sick.
You poison somebody, yeah. No, you poison.
Munchausen is Munchausen. When you make yourself sick
you make
on
yourself,
purpose
or
for
a kid,
attention.
Or a child.
And then Munchausen by proxy is when you do that to a child.
To a child. And then, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the Stockholm
syndrome.
Where you fall in love with your captors or
that's
whatever.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So, and now she's admitting that. Because somebody probably pulled her aside and said, yo, you're going to jail too if you don't just say that they brainwashed you.
In analyses that were hotly contested, assorted psychologists and experts found that Hearst was experiencing various kinds of mental trauma and that she may have been brainwashed to some degree. To what extent Patty Hearst was a perpetrator or a victim has remained in debate ever since.
Huh.
The judge in the case was less than sympathetic to claims of brainwashing, given that Hearst hadn't been in custody for more than 6 weeks before she was releasing audio recordings, specifically denying that she'd been brainwashed.
Yeah.
But that's what a brainwashed person's going to say.
You're right.
They're going to say they're not brainwashed.
Right. It's impossible to know.
Yeah, the jury couldn't really buy it either, and Hearst was found guilty, though one member was visibly crying when the guilty verdict was read. Hearst was sentenced to 7 years in prison, but that was later commuted by President Jimmy Carter in 1979.
Jimmy Carter.
On his last day in office in 2001, President Bill Clinton issued a full pardon for Hearst, who was now married to a former San Francisco police officer and living in the family compound in Wilton, California.
What's a family compound? Well, oh, her big family's rich.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
While Patty Hearst was enjoying her presidential pardon, the last remaining members of the Symbionese Liberation Army were being sent to prison. Four former members had been apprehended for their roles in the Sacramento bank robbery
in
and 2001? Placed on trial in 2002.
What? All the way in 2002, they're still apprehending these guys?
Yep. Mm, the following year, all got sentences of 7 years, except for Emily Harris, the one holding the shotgun, who got 13 years added to a 20-to-life sentence she was already facing for trying to plant bombs under police cars in the 70s.
Dang. Here's the thing. Don't plant bombs on police cars, and you'll probably...
Patty Hearst, who had participated in all of these crimes, was granted immunity as a state witness before the trials began, but never called and so didn't have to give a statement or appear in court to address the infamous crimes. They have all been released. All of the SLA members have been released from prison as of 2009.
Huh.
The only SLA member still in prison is Joe Romero, who killed Marcus Foster in the first action taken by the SLA.
Well, that fucker should stay there, because you don't kill Marcus Foster.
Hearst became prominent in East Coast society in the fundraising scene, particularly involved in the Foundation for Children with AIDS.
You mean after all this? Since?
Yeah.
Really?
On February 16th, 2005, Hearst's dog won the toy category in Westminster Dog Kennel Show at Madison Square
Garden. What? What are we talking about? What are we even doing here? What?
That's how the story of Patty Hearst and the Symbionese Liberation
Army. That's how it ends with her dog winning the goddamn Westminster? What?
She's like a socialite now.
Nobody's preventing her from participating in that?
Well, why? She's pardoned. Fully pardoned.
Fully pardoned, man.
You can't do anything.
That's crazy.
Stockholm syndrome is a thing.
It is. So it might be. She might have been completely.
And, I mean, it's a real thing.
Well, Elizabeth Smart.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Right.
And now look at her. She's dating Jay-Z.
What?
Or
no.
Kanye West or something.
No.
Maybe.
What are you talking about?
She's doing something. She was on a show.
What?
She had a. I don't know. She's.
She's not gonna have a show.
Or she started a nonprofit.
You're crazy. You like that story?
She's got a rap song. No, that was really good.
Was it interesting?
Yeah, that was really good. I'm glad you were doing that because
it's a little twisty and turny.
That's very twisty and turny, and that story came up on my research, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I have enough. I don't know if I just don't know if I have the gumption.
Yeah,
to
I know.
Cover that whole thing.
Yeah.
No, that was good. That was very interesting, and it was a crazy ride. And I've always wanted. I've always heard
about that
Patty Hearst thing. I didn't really know, but you know who I picture. I don't know what she looks like, so I'm picturing Lisa Welchel from Facts of Life.
Oh, no, she doesn't really look like that. She's dark-haired. She's blonde now because she probably colors it, but she was dark-haired at the time.
She was dark-haired back then?
Oh, in her mugshot, her famous mugshot.
So I should picture Joe Polnicek.
She's not very attractive.
If she was a Facts of Life character, who would she be?
Joe, probably.
Joe. Okay.
Yeah.
Joe.
I'm glad you made me go through that exercise.
Throw her a motor. That's what we should do with all women from now on.
Oh, my
If
God.
You were a Facts of Life character.
Which Facts of Life member is she?
Yeah, which Facts of Life member are you, honey? Have you thought about that?
I don't.
I think you're a Tootie.
Tootie?
You're in trouble.
All right, what's
Ooh,
next?
Ooh, make that double. I think that's all the time we have.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's been well over.
Okay.
It's been a long time, so I think
been
we should just cut for
the...
No, that was
now
good.
I'm coming back home.
Sorry. No, don't sing that. That was a perfect way to end. I mean, that was a great story, and
good.
We talked about a lot of shit, and we'll pick back up in, let's
March.
See. I think February 20th, actually, yeah. I have something that...
Jeez, we didn't even get through February?
Yeah, but then this was a big one, but...
Okay, we'll save it then.
But we jumped, you know, we...
We did jump around.
Well, no, we didn't much. I mean, I didn't... That's the last thing I did, but here we get to February 20th. So,
jeez. Oh, man.
We got
a lot to do.
We're going to do a lot of episodes.
12-parter!
But when you have... That's the thing. When you have these stories that are...
You want to get...
You got to know...
You got to know what happened.
You have a lot of questions on what happened. Crazy shit happened in the 70s.
That's right. You're right.
Plus, we decided somewhere along the way from episode one till now, we decided, oh, let's actually do some research so we know what we're talking about.
Right.
And so now when you do research, it's like, shit, there's a lot of info here.
Yep.
Instead of just like, just guessing what you think happened, because in the 90s and the 80s, like, we lived all that,
yeah,
so we kind of remembered some of it. So this,
right.
We don't know any of this. So anyway, thank you for listening. Please
yes.
give us 5 stars.
Yes, rate, review, subscribe
on iTunes, and tell your friends, like tell your neighbors, like your family members, like grab their iPhones, look up American Timelines, give it 5 stars, and then throw their iPhone out the window, punch them in the face.
Don't do that. No, don't do any of that.
Oh, don't do that part. But do the thing, like take their phone and do that. They don't know what a podcast is.
It's probably true.
I turned my microphone off. There's a bunch of ladies like in their 70s that have iPhones that don't listen to podcasts. They don't know how.
You just do it. You just take your grandma's phone.
But on iTunes, just grab her phone and just use it. Say, Grandma, let me see your phone. I'll help you. And you just type in whatever American Timelines podcast and give us 5 stars.
All right, it's time to get out of here, Chuck Berry.
It's time to get out of here, Chuck Berry. It's 1974, guys. We're almost through the 70s halfway. I love Matt Truman. Just listen to him.
Listen to his voice.
How?
Sexy, gorgeous man.
He's fucking Prince mixed with goddamn Mick Jagger. You can't not love him. You can see him at Howard's Club H.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.